راجل غلبان وعمل بيبي وقف راجل غلبان وعمل بيبي عالسور.
All right, that was Israel Harari and Elsur. That is in honor of my guest who is on the phone, Hoda Rashad. Well, welcome to KOWS Radio. You are obviously a teacher, an educator, an author, and you are now coming with Leila Marzouk, the mother of Khaled Said, who really was the catalyst for the Egyptian revolution. So, wow, I'm very honored, and thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. To be on your show.
Now, Hoda, tell me something about yourself, your background, and what you what brings you for doing this.
Well, I moved to America in around 2005, and the plan was for my husband and I to settle here. I had I'd been born in the States, and I left when I was nine. And lived most of my adult life there, but I married an American from Louisville, Kentucky, who wasn't Egypt at the time. So we tried to sort of live there for 5 years, and then he didn't really, he couldn't really acclimate, and we ended up moving. And the only reason that we were there during the revolution was that it was at the time of the economic slump, and the house that we were renting had gone under foreclosure. And we had decided, I was about to give birth, we had decided that right after I have the baby, then we would close up the house and put our stuff in storage, and my husband would remain in the States but would work out of a smaller sort of abode, and I would go have a relaxing year in Cairo with my mother. That was the plan,
okay.
To take the newborn baby. And within 6 months of that plan, the revolution hit. And, of course, it wasn't relaxing because with it, mainly what you had were the circumstances of a war.
Right.
And you had shortages of gas and electricity and stuff like that. And I had been, already I had returned to my job that I had left prior to moving to the States. I started working, having some, like, project-by-project consultancy deals with schools. And I ended up sort of in the middle of things blogging for some of the protesters on the ground. And soon after the abdication happened, because Egypt's revolution was fairly quick, there were 18 days and we saw a result right away,
right.
We began to notice that there were only three or four books out there describing the revolution, and that there were three or four fairly quickly, like within a few months, there were three or four books, and most of them were written by non-Egyptians. And there was, I don't want to say inaccuracy between what was in the books and what happened, but there was a large gap. Like they tended to sort of bundle things into neat compartments and have explanations for things when people on the ground and Egyptians themselves who witnessed this and who went through this as citizens, not just the activists and the people who were involved, sort of had different stories. And Leila Marzouk's story is a very good example of this, because even though her son's image seemed to have triggered the first few days of protest, her story is really a very normal, she wasn't an activist before this.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of happened to her, like it fell on her, like it fell on all of the rest of Egyptians. So it's really interesting, and we ended up putting it in a book with 10 other stories that sort of give background about the different elements involved, including the Christian Egyptians and the Muslim Brotherhood and mothers who were in the 6th of April movement. And it was a very interesting experience for me, and it still is.
Yeah, so you really gave a much broader picture of the magnitude of how it affected everybody in Egypt.
Yes, and more on the human level too. We weren't really interested in picking a side or giving any kind of political analysis, or we were just really describing what if you were here, what would happen to you.
Right now, obviously, we saw Tahrir Square, and mainly, what was happening out in the villages and other towns? I know Alexandria was a hotbed as well, but what was really happening elsewhere?
Well, In the height of the first 18 days, it appeared to be that things were happening simultaneously across each. When I first started researching the book, I thought that it was simultaneous, and most of the people till today thought it was simultaneous. But while I was doing the research, and we understood more about movements such as 6th of April and some of the Mahalla movements and some of the things that were going on since 2007, and that had been planning this, but had planning it, they were planning for it to happen at the election. They weren't planning for it to happen when it did. And Khaled's story, along with Tunisia's events, sort of made it happen at that specific point. So what we thought was simultaneous was actually a planned sort of movement that was coming to life because it saw some triggers. It figured this is the time. And that was very interesting to sort of uncover towards the end that there were that a lot of the work that the activists were doing was actually fruitful, even though they thought it wasn't. Most of them were under the impression that they were alone, that they were far in pew, that they had little coordination. But actually, when they had the right sort of environment for it, they were able to communicate. And most of them had very similar, like they had pre-prepared slogans that they would say in the street so that people, to sort of entice people to come out of their homes and walk with them. They had already done a few exercises on how to transfer gatherings on Facebook into real people on their feet in the street. And even though the percentage of population that has internet access is very small, they sort of found a way to sort of have a town crier environment where one person saw it on the internet, knew dates, knew some rules, and transferred it via word of mouth. So across Egypt, during the 18 days, things were pretty much happening in tandem, and the violence from the police side was also happening at the same intensity. And then it all folded quickly. But now, after the 18 days, we never really got back to where we were after that. So now it's each governorate to its own. And it's kind of scary because that's we're witnessing what it really is to have a democratic adolescence, like they say. We don't know. Everyone has their own inclinations. Very few people have a collective political entity. The only large sort of entity that has ties everywhere is the Brotherhood. People were never really, they never entertained the idea of what they were politically because they never had the chance to express views.
Well, that's
so they didn't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, well, that's really what it all boils down to. Perhaps you can just give a brief summary of 30-odd years of Hosni Mubarak's rule in and over Egypt and what that meant to people.
Well, the 30 years, first of all, I'm almost 37, so basically most of my life, so all I knew was him. All of my life, not but it hits different people. It was affecting different people at different levels. I was part of what they would call like a higher economic class, and for me what it meant was that what I saw on TV when it came to the United States and Europe and the elections and everything, but I always thought that that was an impossibility for me, and I was told always to not aspire to have that and that it would never happen in my lifetime, and I really believed that. And I relayed, I'm ashamed to say that I relayed the same message as a teacher, that you know what, you shouldn't really worry about it too much, this is bigger than you, it's far beyond your hands. And I used to hear stories of torture and hear that people got thrown in jail for no reason. I used to hear that prisoners were being flown in from around the world to our jail cells because we had perfected the art of torture so much. You hear these things growing up, but we had never seen proof of it. As you go down the scale, the less influential you are and the less money you have, you would experience things differently, and especially it seemed at the university level when people started to think and had the time to sort of question these things. That was when most of the crackdowns were happening, and what you would find is really stuff like out of the movies, kind of torture that took place in prisons, the unfairness of the system as a whole, because there was no system of accountability. The justice system was broken police system was broken. So you had a lot of injustice sort of transpiring and regenerating, and it was an environment of despair. But at the same time, the regime had it set up in a way that we would be complacent. It was a happy place. Egypt wasn't those pictures like you see on the news with people yelling and screaming. On the contrary, it's very much sort of like the Paris of the Middle East. We're always having a good time, music in the streets, and even the religious, the sort of conservative Islam is very new to Egypt and is a product of other places. So the 30 years tended to be a period of, this is not our country, this is the regime's country, and we are guests in the country, and we really thought there was no way out of it. And I think that the younger generation, literally, like the kids I was teaching, were the kids who started to like see things happen around the world and be exposed to the internet and say, there's no way that this is like the ceiling that we keep hitting against. And oddly enough, really, the fact that Obama got elected was a big deal for most of the youth, because it sort of showed them that you're not supposed to accept certain things as a given. And the spirit started to change.
Interesting. Just that one one historical moment had ramifications.
Well, they were celebrating in the streets when Obama won.
Wow.
Just because it was someone who had a different name and who had an Arabic name as a middle name. And it was just very, I think, inspiring.
Oh, it was. And but now, you know, in those 30 years, obviously the regime had its fingers in everywhere, and you had to like work with it somehow and hopefully not get too, you know, affected, you know, if they didn't like you. I mean, how was that?
You know what? I remember very clearly my father telling me when I finally was given a car that if an officer stopped me, not to talk back to him, not to get smart, not to question what he's saying, and to be very careful not to be taken to the station.
Yeah.
There was, you always had to solve it. If he wants you to pay something, pay it on the spot. Because you could pay on the spot and you could bribe on the spot.
Right.
So he always used to instruct us to never go into a room with them. So there was always this belief that something iffy was happening. And one of the biggest things with the Khaled Said story was that it was the first time someone had seen an image of someone who had gotten beaten up, especially someone from the middle class who like didn't have a beard and didn't appear to be someone who was a religious fanatic, because the regime always used to scare us with the religious fanatics as much as it scared America with it. Because Hosni Mubarak would tell, like, the regime's here, oh, I'm here because you don't want the brotherhood there and you don't want any Islamic faction here. So we, too, were afraid of the Islamists.
Interesting.
Anytime we would see an Islamist killed, we'd say, oh, he's a terrorist, he must have had a bomb strapped to him, this, this, and that. But Khaled Said looked like a regular 20-year-old, upper middle class. He had his business. He had gotten his computer degree from Philadelphia. He had just come from the States. And when you see his cousins on the news, they look like normal teenagers in America, sort of thing. So the webpage that was done when that was set up when he was beaten.
Well, no, let's go back now. That wasn't in January. This is precedes that into June of 2010.
He got killed in June of 2010.
Right.
And he got murdered in broad daylight in the middle of a street. And it was sort of the police were getting brazen. They were beginning to feel like they were untouchable. And I don't think that they saw all the other underlining elements sort of coming together to sort of oppose that. So they didn't play it very well. So they beat him up first, and then when they figured out he was dead, they threw him in the street and told people to call an ambulance because they had planted drugs in his mouth, and they wanted the ambulance to prove that this was a drug dealer. But the ambulance refused to pick him up and left him in the street, and more people started to see him. So the police panicked and took him to the station and sort of hid him away. And his mother managed to bribe someone to get her in at 3 in the morning with her other son. And the other son took a picture of his face and circulated that face all over the internet.
Yep.
And that's sort of how we got that proof, and things really started boiling. And like I was saying, the webpage was called We Are All Khaled Said, because it was the first time we'd think of, well, if this could happen to him, then it could happen to me. It sort of boiled from there.
Interesting. Yes, I know the face during the revolution was of Wael Ghanim, who started that website. And then he was jailed himself, wasn't he, by the regime?
Yes, he was jailed for about 12 days. Nothing major really happened to him. Again, he's very upper, way up in the economic status. And usually those kind of people get threatened, but nothing really happens. He had Google looking for him, so that was like a big deal. They're not going to sit and torture someone who Google has set up a flyer for him. So everyone thought of him that he was just this kid who was touched by Khalid Said, but he had already been an activist and had been in Dr. Mohamed Al-Baradei's gatherings, who was the first sort of political opposition figure who was gathering youth around him and saying, I'm going to run for president, and saying things that we had never sort of heard of before. So it also was part of the elements that were sort of converging, and that story kind of fell in his lap, and he took that story, put it in the right place, and things sort of moved in the right direction.
And then that's where you, when you were there and you started a blog. What made you, you said you were approached by people, or how did you start that?
My experience was really interesting because what happened was that my husband was there visiting. And he decided to take part in the day of protests where the phones were turned off, the cell phones and the internet and everything was turned off. And that was a fairly dangerous day and sort of tested my notions of nationalism, because when he came back, I was just so panicked that I didn't want him to go back in again, and he had to return the States anyway, and I had to come up with a way to justify that we were not being cowards. And one of the ways that I thought of was, okay, then let me participate in any means possible. And I started to contact the NGOs that had been working with me with the schools and asking them, is there anything I can do? And they said, because of my English and because of the fact that I was web savvy, was if I could set up a blog and just turn off TV for the entirety of the protest, which was actually quite difficult because everyone had it blaring.
Oh, yeah.
They said, please don't watch the news, because what's happening is you listen to the news and you paint the same picture that they paint. And they said, just listen to us. Just take phone calls from us and we'll tell you what's happening in the square. And I started posting, and it sort of took from there. And the interesting part in that is that I didn't know that few of the characters that were reporting to me were actually Brotherhood. And these were people that I had known almost all of my career, had never told me that they were Brotherhood. Had I known that, with the levels of fear I had, I wasn't a very brave blogger. I think I was the only blogger with a fake name. And everyone else had their name up there. I had a fake name, and I remember thinking that the reason I was so scared was that I had so much to lose, and that the regular Egyptian didn't have anything to lose yet, anymore, I mean. It was an eye-opener for me, even, because everyone thinks that if this happens in their country, that they'll be right there in the street with the sign, but it's actually a very... It shows who you are at that moment, and it shows how weak we can be sometimes.
Oh, yeah, we're human, and it all takes us in different ways, you know, and bravery comes in different forms as well.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You must have seen some incredible things.
Yeah, well, I wish I was the kind of person who could have been at the front lines, but being at the back gave me the opportunity to meet all these people who survived it and really, really were interested in relaying it. And surprisingly, it was very difficult to get the message here. We've been taking it mainly to academia because the popular news media get their attention span is very short.
Yeah.
So after the thing is big news and it goes away, I don't think there's a lot of interest in really finding out what really happened.
It's over and done and moving on type of thing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, people understandably have their lives, and it has to be, like I say, quote-unquote, relevant to them. And it has to be something that they can relate to, and a lot of the things that we were going through, I think, weren't relatable. at face value. But when you go through the stories in the book and everything, you'd find that it's the same. It's mothers and sons and people who have dreams and want certain things in their life, and they're not getting it.
And that was the amazing thing about the what they call the Arab Spring, from Tunisia, that really just started spreading out, and obviously the waves are still going.
Now it's sad though that how it doesn't, like, it gets harder with every country.
There's so much in play in Egypt, such a center, you know, politically, economically, culturally. In the Middle East, obviously America has a huge influence there, has, you know, obviously with the Mubarak regime, helped prop it up over the years and keep it going. You know, that change, how have the Egyptian people generally, you know, they've obviously, the father figure is gone. There's been a tumult about leading up to the various elections. Now, how does it feel now? I know, obviously, the Brotherhood won most of the elections, and obviously Morsi is the president. So how is that going down over there now on the street?
It's really not going down very well. There's a big lack of unity. Not a lot of people agree with the Brotherhood being in power, understandably. It seems that most people prefer religion not to be mixed with their politics.
Right.
There's a lot of fear because of what happened in Afghanistan and what happened in Iran. And there's a lot of fear from the Brotherhood. And it's very confused because a lot of them are very respectable figures who were members of the community before, only we didn't know that they were Brotherhood. That sort of impress you, and others are just horrifically scary, sort of backward and non-democratic in what they aim to achieve. So there's a lot of hatred, and there's disunity, and in that too is a lack of true understanding of the democratic vehicle. They don't understand that that once someone wins, they have to wait out their term and sort of create lobbies and have voices and keep going at their political sort of effort. They want to revolt now. They want to demonstrate every time there's something they don't like. And when you have a country that has 80 million people, any small percent of that, when they take to the streets, they take the country down economically and morally and in several ways, in more senses than you would imagine. So it's really tough now. And the economic situation is really tanking, and you have issues that sort of make people change their beliefs. If you don't have electricity and it's above 100, then you can switch what you wanted to say, okay, I want whoever's there to just function. So we had a lot of people who wanted the old regime back because they wanted their electricity and they wanted their gas. And
they were happy as it was, head in the sand. And
they don't understand the process. They're saying, well, this is worse. So what did we gain? There's a lack of maturity. There's a lack of understanding what this is, because none of us have ever done it before.
Well, that's true. You're politically naive at this point in terms of knowing how a democratic system works. Yeah. I mean, we're having struggles in this country, let alone somewhere.
Yeah, I started to notice that. Like, I started actually, I see, believe it or not, parallels between the Republican Party and religious parties like the Brotherhood. I see what we call like our liberals and what's happening with the Democrats. And I can see that we all react in the same way and that our fears are similar. Like when I see the pro-life issues and the issues of homosexuality and what's considered marriage and what's not, the fears are the same. People want to be free, want to have their own way of leading their own life, except with us that we may be worrying about like circumcision of women and veils and what people can eat or drink, whilst here it would be the gay marriage situation. But it's the same. It's really the same issues exactly.
Yeah, working through the same cultural and social
except situation. We don't have the police in full gear now. So every time we have a problem, then a million people step out on the street, and then anything can happen.
Well, that's it. I know the police were the target for the revolution, in a way, as the way to get to the regime. Where are they now? Is there no police? Who is patrolling the streets?
Well, now, thankfully, there is someone in the stations. There's always a question mark about who you're running into. I do have friends who are district attorneys and maybe one or two who are in the force. And I know that these are good people. But it really is, it's who you run into on any given day. You could get a good cop, you could get a bad cop. Some of them are actually trying to get the image back. A fair number of them are disenchanted with the population because when they walk into the streets in their uniforms, they may get cursed at, they may get spit at. So they're not very excited about protecting people either. So even now that they're actually present, because in the beginning we had a few months where there was no one in the station, and that was really freaky because they were like on the road to my house. My house was off a desert road. You could see weapons being sold on the sides of the road for normal people who wish to protect themselves. So,
oh, wow.
And this is a civilized, this is downtown Cairo. This is it's like me saying that it happened in San Ramon. being sold in the street. So it was really scary when there was no police. Now that they're back, it's really the luck of the draw. Like, we had an incident with our home being broken into. My father went to the station and was treated very nicely, but he was worried all the time. He was worried that the police had been the people who broke into the house, because my house was broken into fairly after the book was published, and nothing was taken except computers and stuff.
Oh, interesting.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, but we never really figured out what's happening. So it's like you have these question marks everywhere. And even though we know that the army wasn't supposedly very happy with the Brotherhood, but now they seem to be protecting them. So,
yeah, that's an interesting twist. To me it looked like there was a little stage management going on somehow, that they allowed Morsi to push them around somehow. Was that your impression? That's what I got.
I think that's everyone's impression. No one has faith that it was that easy, because you have to understand that even if he is elected and he wins, he goes into, it's like going into a company where all the employees have been hired by another boss.
Right.
He can wake up in the morning and say, well, the schedule today is so-and-so, but no one has to do it. So the fact that they were doing it sort of raises an eyebrow to why are they listening to him, since there's nothing, he has nothing.
Yeah.
Of course, gradually he started firing people and hiring his own team, and then I think people started sweating a little bit. But there really isn't a single entity in Egypt who can forcefully say, you know, I have this code cracked. I think anyone who claims that they know what's going on would really be telling a falsehood. Because there are different powers at play, and they're struggling. And it's a day-to-day scenario. And I think that even old regime elements that are still in the system, if they're army or otherwise, they themselves are playing it on a day-to-day basis. No one saw this in 2010.
Right. So they're just trying to say where the chips are going to fall, I imagine, and go that way.
Yeah, I honestly think that if they had known what they know now, that they wouldn't have taken Mubarak out. I don't think that they would have found it necessary. They were taken by surprise by the number of people in the street, and they sort of overreact by taking him down. I think he could have survived this easily.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard that type of theory. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, because we weren't going to turn into Syria. It's not the kind of country where people are very laid back. They wouldn't have really, it wouldn't have reached those kind of levels, and the police wouldn't have been that blatant in its crackdown, and it would have somehow reached a happy medium with people just saying, okay, we just want this over, we want the economy back. That's sort of the Egyptian psyche. These are people who are used to a good standard of life.
Right, and relatively peaceful.
Relatively peaceful. Yeah. That would be the place to go in any time before 2010. If you wanted a fun place to go in the Middle East that was safe and happy, was Egypt. We used to walk in the street at 3 a.m. and nothing would happen. Even if your non-veiled. We have whole streets that are used to be like, you know, like the red light district. We have the Haram Street that was all belly dancers and stuff. And you could go at any hour. Nothing happened to you. This was Egypt was sort of the Hollywood of the Middle East. And so it's. I think they overreacted, and the number of deaths that happened, and the number of people willing to die sort of scared them. I don't think that scares them anymore, though. And I don't think people react the same way. Now, if you we do have images like Khaled Saeed circulating, a lot of them very soon after the abdication, where people were run over and you would have their faces of people smashed in the street, and it did not garner the same reaction, and it did not garner the same sense of unity. The tragedy is no longer unify the people like they used to.
But it's going to be a struggle. I know that the sort of intellectuals were you know, a lot of the people who were in the street in Tahrir didn't get it going their way. That obviously the Muslim Brotherhood had a much bigger head start in the process.
The Muslim Brotherhood, what I discovered from the book, had like a fraternity set up in place where it was adopting young men and women very early out of college, and it gave them potential to have jobs. Financial security. There was a lot of medical programs if you didn't have the money, and they really earned what they have, whether or not one agrees with them and is afraid of them or not, like me. But they have done their homework, and that's why they are where they are. It is a lesson if people look at it to sort of, okay, then instead of sort of whining or being angry about it, why don't the intellectuals set up similar systems and pool money and learn to funnel wealth in certain ways and sort of be part of that?
Right. Well, it's a new thing for everybody.
Yeah, it's new for everybody. And apparently it isn't like what we see on TV. We're all learning. We're all learning. It's very, very hard. And I feel really that it's heroic to be in Egypt if you choose to stay there during the certain circumstances, or any other Arab country that's going through the spring. If you choose to remain there, no matter what your beliefs are, left, right, middle, it's heroic to exist in countries that go through this kind of adolescent process. And just sticking with it and not fleeing is in and of itself something to admire.
That's a very good point. Now, Leila Marzouk is now, is she coming directly from Egypt?
No, she was in Philadelphia visiting her other son. Two of her sons live in America. It's an interesting one of the interesting things that I found out in the book is that everyone in Egypt has some kind of relationship with America. Doesn't matter, big, small, poor, everyone, poor, rich, everyone has a relationship with America, which is it's interesting. And I remember growing up seeing the American flag on cars there. So America is still a big thing there. It just depends on who you're talking to, and are you talking about politics, or are you talking about entertainment? Anyway, she's here, and she did say that though she's here to visit family, that she will welcome any opportunity to further what's happening in Egypt, to bring accuracy to the stories. So she was invited to Washington, D.C., and I believe she met with people from the American-Egyptian Strategic Alliance and gave a few talks there. And I suggested to the community here that it is of utmost importance that she be exposed to the students that I've been giving presentations to throughout the last 6 months, and that they actually see the face of the people we're talking about and hear her talk about her son who only died 2 years ago. And hear her also talk about what she went through in the election campaign, because she chose a candidate and supported him publicly and on television, and that candidate lost. And she experienced firsthand how, though she is immensely popular, that she may lose luster a little bit if she shows that she chose a side, and if that side isn't the majority sort of popular side to choose. And also she is very active in promoting the unity between the religions and has gone out of her way to sort of embrace martyrs of Christianity in the revolution and put them at the forefront and not have her son as the main symbol there. And I think that these are issues that really need to be discussed in America, and Americans need to see that though they may hear of the tensions that are real there, there's no doubt about it.
Right.
There are efforts, and there are a lot of people who are attempting within this mess to sort of solve the risks that are appearing.
Exactly, that's the thing. People haven't given up, even though they may have lost, mm-hmm. you know, in the election. Hopefully they haven't gone away, that they will make those, establish those institutions that could, you know, bring them into power.
Yeah, and a lot of those who lost, including Wael Ghanim, who had been supporting a different candidate, Laila Marzouh, who had been supporting a different candidate, a lot of them, the day that the president, that President Morsi won, said, we'll bury the hatchet and we'll unify. But on the other hand, there's a vast number who haven't. And I believe that that's holding us back, that we should treat the Brotherhood as an entity in power now. Doesn't mean they're in power for life, and that we accept the responsibility that from here on out, this is our fight, and we continue with it while working with him to make the country go forward. Because really, if you claim that it's over when we took the president out, it's sort of like saying that a parent's role is over at conception.
Right.
This is something that you have to maintain and nurture and make sure that it goes in the right way.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Yeah, with as you said, those 18 days, that was a huge adrenaline rush, basically. And but it takes the stamina after that to make something happen.
And no one really, like, I think the vast majority lose their stamina as soon as the economic situation hits your own health. When you run out of diapers, and you become unnationalistic. Seriously, it really boils down to that.
Yeah, like very basic things. Now, economically, you know, how much have things gone up? You know, what's happened since last year?
There has been, of course, tourism was our biggest hit. No one will come in these circumstances, and that was a big part of our revenue. There's a lot of the stock market kept crashing. There has been some stability, and I'm sure you heard of the IMF wants to participate in that. Finally, Hillary Clinton visited, and there's a lot of talk that there will be financial help. We're unstable. We just emerged from basically a war, even if it's with ourselves. But
right.
We're emerging, and of course, the economy is really it's being hit.
Yeah, it's going to take time when people get some confidence back that things are working there and it's safe.
I think that a lot of people feel that Egypt is worth investing in, and that in and of itself is positive.
Yeah. Well, as you say, the people are wonderful. I know it was certainly the most welcoming and hospitable people I've ever met in any country I've been to. That's all I can say. So,
I think that the message really now should be, and why Leila is here and everything, is to sort of give us a chance to understand our struggle and give people a chance and understand that though you may see we understand that issues with the border are real issues, and that there are security concerns with Israel, and there's a number of things happening, but really, really, it's been such a short amount of time, and this nation needs a chance to sort of stand up and accept that the struggle will be ugly, maybe for everyone for a while.
Well, right, and I think hopefully maybe you can tell us something about the event Laila Marzouk is going to be at this coming Wednesday.
Yes, on Wednesday she's giving a presentation at 2:30 in Santa Rosa University. And
wait, is it 1 to 2:30?
It starts at 2:30.
Oh, it starts at 2:30, okay.
It starts at 2:30 in Lark Hall. The details are on our Facebook page, the Facebook page of the book, which is Rising from Tahrir. Rising from Tahrir is on Amazon, and the proceeds from it are being donated to projects in Egypt. And Laila Marzouk and the other individuals in the book are in it because of that, because they're promoting this sort of fundraising for this. That event, I believe the Santa Rosa is open to the public, so you can anyone who wishes to come in, they can. And she's also going to be in Berkeley on Monday at 7:30 in the International House in the Great Room. And for me, with the most important people, I think the academia and students and the younger generation who has the time to really look closely at this. This is the most important sort of part of the population that needs to understand these things as they sort of go into positions of power and of influence. But thankfully, we are in the internet age, and if you really are interested in a place, it's become very easy to find out more than what you see on the net.
Yes. Well, with that, I thank you so much, Hoda Rashad, for this wonderful insight into what's happening in Egypt and your
thank
efforts
you
to...
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy that we got this opportunity.
Be
Great
ready.
Night.
Thank you so much,
Bye-bye.
Hoda. Thank you. Bye-bye.